I think if you live long enough, the bio just gets longer, right? Thank you, Bishop. That was very gracious. It is a great privilege to be here. It's also, I have to say, a little intimidating. I know enough people to know who you are and how competent and sophisticated and thoughtful and capable and gifted you are, that it's not as if I just sort of dropped in and I'll leave. I'll see a lot of you again. So there's a sort of a higher bar of authenticity and accountability that comes with that. I also have to say it's a small world. The rector who started this whole journey for me is sitting in this room. And we haven't seen each other. Jeff, how long has it been? We haven't seen each other in 25 years, and he walks up to me, and I go, I know you. He is the rector who saw a Stanford senior come into his parish in Menlo Park, California, at that point in her journey where she was, you know, discerning, could the Episcopal Church hold on and hold my capacity for imagination and wonder about God, having been through my evangelical sort of, you know, campus crusade, intervarsity Christian fellowship journey. I was in this, am I really a Christian? Does my church really believe in Jesus? Who am I really? What is it all about? And I walk in the door, and the rector sees me, probably, you know, the one young adult that Sunday, I don't know, and he invites me to start being a part of a congregation that cared a lot about people. And particularly cared a lot about young people, and invited me right alongside of his work and ministry with a bunch of other amazing volunteers to start doing youth ministry. You know, the classic young adult help with youth program, except that in that program, I was formed. In that program, I had mentors. In that program, I was asked to do some of the heavy lifting, but only after I had sat with others who were experienced and knew about why we were doing what we were doing. And thanks to Jeff, I fell into my first camp role, and so it goes on. So anyway, we all have a story, and it's woven together in this room, and I am very grateful. So if I were to stop talking now, I think the takeaway I want you to be excited about is that you probably already have, right where you are, the gifts, the resources, the capacities to walk with other people, to nurture them in faith in ways far beyond what you have already done. I'm not here to tell you about new programs or to tell you that what you're doing is wrong. What I want is to help us imagine the real worlds we live in, some of the realities that we see every day that are troubling us and are demographically true, and inside those realities to recognize the wonder and majesty of our God. And that we are called in relationship to God in the way of Jesus to help other people experience that same wonder and awe and transforming experience that we have understood enough to bring you here for 2 days in the middle of the woods to study more, to pray more, to celebrate more. So my hope is that when you leave, you will be thinking more in terms of processes than programs, that you will be thinking more in terms of what God is already doing in your midst, and less about what you're not doing, that you'll be thinking more about what is unique and holy and set apart for you and your people in the place you are called to serve, not so much what's the church down the road doing, but what are you called to be and do right there, right now. And so all of this is intended to be sort of an inspiration and an affirmation of those things holy, and a willingness to walk toward those things that are holding us back. A willingness to say, this is not working. I can let it go. So, the work we're doing together, the forming of faith, the passing on of this great tradition that is called Christianity, that we, many of us, think is even more exciting when we experience it through the Episcopal expression, is not new work, right? Every religious tradition has had its mechanism for passing on what it believes. Some, the Shakers, didn't do so well, right? Some fight more than they pass. You know, if you use your sports metaphor, there are football teams that play really well and they move the ball, and there's others that do a lot of tackling. You know, how do we pass on what we love? How do we pass on what we know to be true in a world that really, really needs it? So it is not original work. We go to our roots as Christian people. We go to our heritage with our Jewish traditions, and we know from the Shema, we know from that ancient, beautiful text in Deuteronomy, that at the centerpiece of Jewish tradition are the morning and the evening prayers. At the centerpiece of daily life is the theological identity in their prayer book, the Siddur, that is in fact what children learn first, beckoned by their parents into the acknowledgement of a holy life. Hear, O Israel, the Lord God is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Keep these words that I am commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children. How many of our parents can recite scripture to their children? And talk about them when you are at home and when you are away, when you lie down and when you rise. Not just on Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock, not just at youth group, not just at the vestry meeting, all the time, morning, noon, night, bedtime. Bind them as a sign on your hand, fix them as an emblem on your forehead, and write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Be who you are. Be who God created you to be. And tell your children about that. As fast forward to the New Testament, to Matthew, to the Great Commission, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age. Now, I'm not here to debate the theological issues of missiology with this, but I am here to say God is sending us out. God is sending us out to do what we're called to do, to make other people know that there is a God who loves and forgives, to invite, to create environments where the joy that we know and the transforming identity we experience at the font can be theirs. They have free will. They can choose not to follow. But if they've never heard it, if they've never known, and if they don't know God in some other living form, we have a lovely, lovely story to tell. And we have life-changing experiences to share. So every time you and I, in your cases, who are priests, baptize, and those of us who are lay people and deacons, witness the baptism, we have an opportunity constantly to be realigned with our own sense of the will of God for our lives. We often talk about all of those baptismal promises, the things we'll do, but I love the beginning of the questions throughout the baptismal covenant. Do you believe? Will you continue? Will you persevere? Will you proclaim? Will you seek and serve? Will you strive? These are not passive terms, right? These are not, you know, convenience, you know, Sunday church that just sort of fits because it's comfortable and I like the people who show up. These are radical action verbs. These are things that are going to make me do something and be something in the world that is different because of my baptism. We also answer the question, will you be responsible for seeing that the child you present is brought up in the Christian faith and life? So when we present a child for baptism, when we are a godparent privileged to be the sponsor of someone's baptism, we answer that question saying confidently, I will, with God's help. So we have promised, many of us in this room, to do this work of forming faith, at least for those whose baptisms we have witnessed. We have promised that we will continue to walk in the way of Christ through our own baptismal identity. And it's so easy to become comfortable and complacent and to think that we're good, we do life well, we don't murder, you know, we don't steal, we live responsible lives, we are generous, and those are all wonderful qualities. But those are not radically Christian qualities. Other people are good and generous and don't steal and don't kill. Those are not qualities that have redeemed me into something I was not before. I would have probably been a good person if I hadn't been baptized. But as a baptized person, I have a chance to believe in a life with God that where death has no sting, where I do not need to be afraid, where I do not need to wonder if I am loved. I am loved because God loved me first. You are loved because God loved you first. And in a world of fear, acute fear, people long to know that they are worthy and they are loved. We know this. I'm speaking to the choir, right? Preaching to the choir. I wish I could sing to the choir. I love that the bishop almost introduced me as the director of the Center for Music, his wife's center. You do not want me to be the director of anything musical. I'll go. I'll cheer. But that would not help. My gifts are not there. But what I do know is I do know something, my own experience of being brought into this radical transforming love, the forgiveness that has allowed me to rebuild my life and be better because of it. We also say in our baptismal covenant, we respond to, will you by your prayers and witness help this child to grow into the full stature of Christ? So not only will we promise to nurture them in their journey with Christ, in their faith, in their becoming more fully the Imago Dei, the child of God that they were created to be, the image of God, the direct image of God, but we actually promise every time we baptize, witness, and stand with others at the font that we will in fact practice what we believe to be our calling through prayer and action. And that by being faithful Christians, we will create environments, ecologies, systems that are by their very space and being formative. When your household practices faithfully, children grow up and are enculturated into a practice of believing that there is one God who loves us and forgives us. When your household says grace, your children know that there's time to be intentional about acknowledging the source of creation, about the abundance and blessings of our lives. When we do things in the world in the name of our faith, quietly or loudly, but when we live out loud in the world, in public, and take risks because of our faith, we are witnessing to the full stature of Christ. And without those audacious promises, we're kind of just nice people. But those audacious promises make us really different. They should. That's what I want to convince us of. Unfortunately, there's a whole lot of people in our lovely country, and I love this country, which is, as you many of you know, one of the most religious nations in the world. We score way up there in the top five, one of the most religious countries in the world, with incredible religious freedoms. Our First Amendment rights are extraordinarily sturdy and something we should all never forget to be grateful for. But in the midst of that, in our wonderfully religiously diverse world of North America, what we have is extraordinary levels of religious illiteracy. We have people who think they are something but don't know what that something really means. We have people who don't want to be anything because they think they know what something else is and that something else looks scary or is judgmental or has a value system that they don't believe they understand or value. So we have a lot of confusion in the public square about what we actually believe and what the other person believes. And by not knowing more accurately who we are, it's both difficult to engage thoughtfully and respectfully with people of religious diversities different from our own, and it's incredibly difficult to pass on our own faith when we don't have our own language of faith or confidence about that. So our work as leaders in the church is particularly critical at a time when we'll talk a little bit about the statistics, but we have a lot more people who don't know why they believe what they believe or say now they don't believe than we have people confidently knowing who they are and what they believe. So with religious literacy, Stephen Prothero, who is a scholar at Boston University, describes religious literacy as the ability to understand and use the religious vocabulary, symbols, images, beliefs, practices, scriptures, heroes, themes, and stories that are used in American public life. So he's saying, if you and I are religiously literate, we can recognize in art that there is religious symbolism. We can see it in poetry. We recognize religious language in the news. We recognize when people are dressed in certain ways that are becoming of their tradition. It's surprising how few of those symbols people recognize on the street today. People have stereotypes about a woman who chooses to wear the hijab, who's Muslim. They think that that means certain things about her beliefs about herself or about her relationship to men that are completely inaccurate. People see a cross and they make assumptions about what we are as Christians. But what he goes on to say in some very simple research that he did a few years ago, 10% of American teenagers can name all five of the major world religions. 10%. But 15% cannot name any. So 15% of American teenagers that he surveyed, and it was not a hugely statistically sound poll, but it was curiously accurate, 15% of the kids he talked to couldn't even say Christianity was a major world religion. Now, some of those kids said things like Baptist or, you know, Congregational. I doubt they said Episcopalian. They might have. But they said denominational identities, but they didn't know to say Christian. 50% of those same high school seniors that he talked to think that Sodom and Gomorrah were married. And 60% of American adults believe that the Bible holds almost all or most answers. That's good news, perhaps, right? Until you go a level below that, 50% of those 60% cannot name one gospel. So the Bible is sacred. The Bible has the answers. I will use the Bible in my defense. But when you really scratch below the surface, they don't know much about the Bible. What he goes on to say is that this kind of religious illiteracy makes it difficult for Americans to make sense of a world in which people kill and make peace in the name of Christ or Allah. So we have a level of religious complexity that is extraordinary in our country. But if he's right, and I think he is, that religious illiteracy is right next to it, we have complexities that confuse and in many cases polarize. And it gets almost silly. This we found this week in a store. Two punch balls with imprinted peace signs. So you can punch all you want the peace out of the ball. I mean, I don't mind punch balls, they're fun. But I'm not quite sure why they needed to be imprinted with peace signs. So I do believe that there is a pervasive uncertainty in our country about religion and about what we believe. And I think that it breeds fear, and I think it leads to escapism. I think people are literally not paying attention. And I think that attention is the fruit of peace. I think the attention is the fruit of spiritual disciplines. And I think our society is more driven, as many of you experience it too, I expect, by fear and anxiety than it is by hope and love. And therefore, we are easily lured towards consumption. We are easily lured to try to satisfy our hungers, spiritual and otherwise, through relationships and behaviors and practices that are not of God. They are not healthy. They are not the things that bring us joy. And they are not lasting. And I think we are tempted to exile those things from which we cannot escape, or we are tempted to solve issues that are difficult and cause us to be afraid by closing doors, by literally incarcerating millions of people, by literally narrowing immigration policies, by literally establishing healthcare policies that carefully excise from any policy the kinds of prevention that we really need to bring about full public health. So that's a world that it's a gloomy picture of North America, but it is very real. We are more divided than we have ever been on many issues. And yet the church continues to believe what we believe about our God. And unfortunately, many of us, even in our faithfulness, are falling short. So the nuns, this is not new information, right? 2012, Pew Research. But what's important is that we need to notice that still today, the fastest growing religious demographic in our country are the self-identified nuns, N-O-N-E-S's, not the religious. Okay, the people who say, kind of with a shrug in their shoulders, oh, I'm nothing. This particular graph, which you can't see well, the darkest line at the bottom is the percentage that self-identify as atheist. The gray band in the center is the agnostics, and the largest, lightest color on the top are just the shruggers. Well, I'm nothing in particular. And if you push them, they might say, oh yeah, well, I'm Christian. I'll go to with my parents at Easter, you know, or, you know, oh, I'm Jewish. You know, we keep you know, the Sabbath, or we practice Passover, or, you know, we have a couple of things that we do. I love gefilte fish or whatever they tell you, but it's part of a cultural tradition in many cases. It's an inherited set of practices, but it isn't a transforming experience of faith. So at this point in time, 1 in 5 Americans is religiously unaffiliated, and it's even higher. It's 1 in 3 for people who are under 30. And people are voting with their feet. What I believe is that this is an indictment, in a sense, to us, that we are not living this good news that we claim in ways that people find relevant. It's not that God is not God, and that God is not sturdy, and that God cannot weather this storm. Of course God can. But the question is, can we let ourselves become the churches, the schools, the ministries that truly welcome people into the center of what we believe to be true? This I'm showing you not because you can read it, but it is the top 3 religious traditions by each state, okay? And the purple is Roman Catholic. The green are the nuns, the unaffiliated, and then the blues are various brands of Protestant. I'm going to give you a closer-up view of Virginia, which is right here. So Virginia, bottom of this third, has the 3 top religious identities in this state. 21% of us, okay, are white evangelicals. 21% of us are unaffiliated. And 16% of us are white mainline Protestant. So we actually show up in Virginia on the graph. White mainline Protestant does not show up in a whole lot of other parts of the country. This is white mainline Protestant. So there's places where it doesn't show up at all, and there's places where it's just a lot smaller. So what would nun behavior actually look like? What might it look like where you are? You've seen it. It means that people are no longer assuming that they're going to have a religious funeral. We've always thought, well, they just don't come to church on Sunday, but they'll bring their kids back when they're going to be baptized, or of course they'll have a funeral. Well, back in 2008, 27% of people were already saying they really did not expect to have a religious funeral. And those were people dying and anticipating death in 2008. So these are people who probably were baby boomers and older. 44% of people in another survey from Baylor said that they spend no time seeking eternal wisdom. As I said to a group earlier of chaplains, I'm not sure I would know how I would answer a question if someone asked me, do you spend any of your time seeking eternal wisdom? It's an odd question, and there's a lot of methodology in surveys. You know, you can tweak the results you get by the way you create the items, the questions. But if this is at all true, our sort of mythology that everybody is seeking and everybody's asking the big questions may not be as accurate as we thought. I don't think they're not asking the questions means that their hearts do not long to be in relationship with a loving and forgiving God. But I do think that part of the religious illiteracy is that people have not developed the cognitive capacity to intellectualize and articulate and speak the language of interaction that comes with faith and spirituality. So yoga, they're much better talking about yoga than they are talking about the specifics of a religious tradition. They're much better about talking about their sports practices. They're much better about talking about how they eat well, which diet, the paleo diet or the this diet or the that diet that they're on, and they know why and they're very articulate, but not so comfortable seeking, asking, discussing what it means to be a person of faith. When people were asked in a Gallup study, what helps you to grow in faith? This is in the US, where predominantly people still identify as Christian, whether they know what that means or not. The church was not in the top 10 items that people responded when they said, what helps you grow in faith? People didn't say church. They said all sorts of other things. My mother, the Bible, my friends. They didn't say church. Summer camp showed up. 51% of people say that the church is not to or not at all important to them. Church attendance, as many of you know, has been falling. In 2004, 43% of Americans went to church regularly, which was at least twice a month. In 2014, 36% of people were going to church regularly. Twice a month isn't that often. 4 out of 10 said that they had attended church this past week, but only 2 out of 10 millennials say that church is important. So again, we have a generational change, and we have a general slide in the direction we don't really want to see. As you probably have seen too, the Barna study that came out in 2011 talks about those millennials. It talks about young adults and says, you know what, they're leaving. And they'll tell us why they're leaving. And these are the ones who left. These are not the ones who never came, which is a whole lot of young adults because their parents were not active in a faith tradition. But the young adults who've left our churches are saying it's boring, it's judgmental, it's overprotective, it's exclusive, it's unfriendly towards doubters, it's antagonistic towards science, and it's shallow. Now, if you listen to that list carefully, at our best, we are not most of those things. Our Anglican Episcopal heritage is not antagonistic towards science. We are not shallow people. We are willing to wrestle with deep questions. I hope we are not unfriendly towards doubters. I mean, we talk about reason as a significant identity structure within our tradition. But kids on the streets, young adults on the streets, think all churches are the same. And this is what they're afraid they're going to find. Now, on the other side, when asked why do you go to church, what we find is that churchgoers, no matter their age, no matter their denomination, no matter their background, no matter who they were and how they grew up, the majority of them say they value church because it is a place that I can be closer to God. So the people who are going, the people who are hanging in there, those of us who like church, recognize that, in fact, our first reason for going is not to be busy, it's not to be on a committee, it's not to do 15 things, it's actually to be closer to God. But after that, the system, the questions, they go all sorts of different directions about why people come. But the two top reasons that unchurched Americans said that they don't go to church, so people who don't go, how come you don't go, were always the same. I find God elsewhere. So I don't need to go look for the God you say you find at church. I find God elsewhere. And church is not relevant to me personally. I'm glad it's nice for you. It's awesome that it's great for you. It's lovely. You're really a nice person. I'm glad it's on the street corner. Maybe someday I'll need you. But I don't need it. It's not relevant for me. So if we move beyond just sort of broad studies like that, how many of you are aware of the Willow Creek research that was done that came out a couple years ago, the Reveal study? So Bill Hybels, is that a familiar name? He started Willow Creek Church outside of Chicago, right? Founding pastor. The church has been, you know, it's 40,000 people. I mean, it's 20,000 members. I mean, it's a huge church. If you visit it, it's like visiting a junior campus, a junior college. There's just buildings and buildings and parking lot all around it with minivans that bring you from the perimeter into the church. There's a barista in the lobby. There's bookstores. There you walk in and there is a huge invitation for translation equipment into like 7 languages. It's got it all, right? They have a whole wing for social justice ministries. There's a grocery store. There are on-site counselors. There are work counselors and provision. It's an amazing enterprise. Bill retired from this work, and they hired another pastor. And you can imagine that being that pastor, following the first founding pastor, was not an easy job, and it did not work out well. And so they asked Bill to come back. The elders in the congregation, the councils asked him to return for a period of time to kind of begin to redeem the losses that they had begun to feel. And Bill went back, but he went back with a fresh eye. And what Bill realized was that while the church was thriving, I mean, this is a bigger church than if we put all of our churches together, I suspect, you know. This church is thriving by every measure you could see. What he realized was they had as many people most coming in the front door as they had quietly leaving the back door. So they were not growing at the rate that they should have been if you count their newcomers and visitors. And he said, there's something wrong with this picture. We think that we are all about building a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. We think we're all about changing people's lives. We think we're all about helping people fall more in love with God. But something's not working. And he was brave enough to go out and find and hire a professional research company. They happened to be led by an Episcopalian, which is kind of fun, who then conducted a fully rigorous scientific study of the congregation. And that study and that methodology has now been made been shared across denominations. But basically, what they did by surveying every member, every staff person, every person that had any affiliation with the church, interviewing deeply, was that they discovered some very basic things that we might even intuit. The level of church activity a person has nothing to do with their spiritual growth. The busier you are, the more engaged you are, does not have anything to do with whether you are actively growing in faith. In fact, there's some negative relationship, that you can become more cynical, more tired, more rote, habitual about what you were doing with your faith life. But the biggest thing is, the busier core leaders of their church were some of the people who were recognizing that they were feeling out of relationship with God, that mystery, that wonder had somehow slipped away. They found that 1 in 4 of their core leaders were spiritually stalled. 1 in 4. In a church that has every kind of programming you can imagine, online, face-to-face, small group, incredible preaching, 1 in 4 acknowledged that they were not growing, that they felt stuck, that they had questions that they couldn't answer and they didn't know what to do. They discovered that leadership really matters, that one of the mistakes that they were making was that they were too leadership dependent. They were not equipping people to do their own work with God. They were doing it for them. So while they thought they taught all of this goodness about the Christian tradition, they were giving it to people as they thought they needed it, rather than allowing people to engage it personally. And they said, fundamentally, we want more Bible. We want a closer relationship to God, and we want to know the scriptures. Now, this is a church that does nothing but teach the Bible, right? Bible study, Bible study, Bible study, preaching from the Bible. What they realized was they weren't putting the Bible in people's hands in the same way that they should be. They were preaching about, they were interpreting for, they were explicating, and they were inspiring, but they were not giving people the tools that they needed to wrestle with their own understanding of the text. That has now been proven to be true across all of our mainline denominations, that our folks want more experience of Scripture. They're embarrassed that they don't know anything. They want to know, and they don't necessarily want to come on Thursday night at 7:30 to the Bible study that's been going on for 40 years. They want other ways of getting there, okay? Now, in addition to the nuns, have some of you been reading about the duns? So these people I'm a little more worried about. These are the folks who look a lot like us. They're people who have been core members of the church, deeply involved, probably senior wardens. People, maybe many times, people who have given a lot of time and money and conviction to the church and have invited their friends and have brought their kids to Sunday school and have been doing this for a long time. And some of them, and increasingly large numbers of them, are just washing their hands of church and saying, I'm done. I'm not coming back. I'm not looking for another church. I'm done. I am kind of with God in my own way, but I do not want to have anything to do with the institution. Those folks I am concerned about because, in a sense, the institution has damaged their spiritual life. In a sense, we have allowed that to happen. And I think we have a moral responsibility not to chase them, because that's not what they're asking, but to take seriously that there are new ways of God working in their lives and that we may have to be very creative in praying for them and supporting them and honoring them, but in a sense, never giving up on them. So Edwards Deming, my favorite quote, said this to the mid-20th century, flailing American auto industry: your system is perfectly designed to give you the results that you're getting. Right? So just keep doing what you're doing and you'll get the results you're getting. It's not that what we're doing is bad. It is feeding the souls of the people that are involved. We're doing some really good work and incredible ministry. And our music programs are wonderful in many places. There's lots that's good. But what's so sad to me is it's so good and there's so many people who are not part of it yet. And that's what we have to be willing to reimagine. It's not about selling out. It's about welcoming to join and us going out to join them. So here we are. I am, like I said, not telling you that I want you to deconstruct what you've got unless it really is not working. What I do want is for us to realize that faith formation is not a program. Faith formation is not a class. Faith formation is a lifelong process that begins at the font, and it begins before we're baptized, actually. It begins when God brings us into being, and it goes all the way through our lived mortal lives, all the way to the resurrection. We are never fully formed. We are always becoming ever more fully who God wants us to be. It is a dynamic, exciting, incredible journey. And in that process, it is not all in church. It is life-wide also. It is happening at home, on the street, at work, in the grocery store, at the doctor's office, with your children, with your nieces, with your nephews, with the person you love, with the person you just had a fight with. It's happening all the time. And the church has been so focused on the formal education of religious education that we have under-resourced, I believe, what I would call the life-wide education. So we have a mission, it's in our prayer book, and it's to restore all people to unity with God and each other in Christ. The language of restore is interesting. You know, it's this idea that we have fallen away, we need to come back. We can talk about original sin, but in today's real time, restoring has more weight to it for me. There are people who think they know something of our heritage. People who think they know something of what they believe, but they don't have the whole story. They have some of the puzzle. Have you ever tried to do a puzzle and you get almost to the end and there's some pieces missing and it is so frustrating? And it's just those pieces that are gonna fill out a picture right in the middle. That's part of what restoring is about. What can we bring to people's lives that they don't yet know? So I can see fatigue and warmth. I'm gonna show you something very theoretical, but I think it's helpful. So I'm gonna ask you to stand up for a second. Just stand up and stretch. Reach. Remember, you are human, and you have a body, and invite some air deep into your lungs. The breath of life from God, the Spiritus, and blow that out to share with the universe. And take your seats. You're welcome. I'm going to share with you, anyone who's been in my classes, bear with me, I'm sorry, this is probably a repeat. You all have that kind of one tune we play. I have that one theoretical model that I return to a lot because I think it works and I think it's helpful. And I use it as a sort of a diagnostic for congregational or Christian community life. And I just want to share it with you because I think it helps us reimagine the giftedness of our congregations or our schools or our faith communities in ways that we might not notice. And it's called the wedge. So in this wedge, what I want you to imagine is that it's like it's a big open triangle, right? At the wider end, at any given time, there are more people. In this room right now, more of us are sitting spiritually in terms of our faith development at the wider end than we are at the narrower end. The narrower end is not a better end. It is not hierarchical. You're not more loved by God because you are somewhere else in your faith journey, but you are constantly being invited by God to come closer. And this model helps me understand something about how we journey toward that maturing faith. I don't think there is a sort of list of 12 items that you accomplish and then you are a mature Christian. I think there is a lifelong process of maturing in faith, and there are signs that we see of people who we recognize have mature faith. And that's the kind of environment that we want to cultivate, an environment that invites people to their best selves, to become practitioners of deep faith. So at that widest end of the wedge, this is based on John Westerhoff, an Episcopal priest and religious educator of the 20th century's theoretical work. At the widest end, our spiritual need is to experience faith. We're not thinking about it. We are just wanting to know that we are loved. This is small children, before they have any cognitive capacity to understand who God is, they know love when they experience it. They know delight. So we need to, all of us who are human, experience what it means to be loved. In Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you have basic needs, right? You need food, you need water, you need shelter. Those things have to be met before we are ready to be emotionally present to the people around us. So in this model, Ministries that meet people there are ministries of welcome. They're ministries that express a theology of invitation. So it's everything we do in the life of our congregations or our schools that are fully available and accessible to the visitor, the newcomer, the person who came along as a friend. It's all of the things we do, from signage to good bathrooms to nice coffee to, you know, making sure the door that we say is the front door really is the door. You know, you don't have to kind of know the secret handshake to go to the back and get in the kitchen and come up the front. That we actually are as welcoming as we say we are, and that our spaces and that our practices exude that kind of welcome. You and I, who are priests and lay people and leadership in the church, we know something of that intuitively. So we kind of blitz by it. We can put up with some of the noise that is distracting because we see people we know. We feel connected. But if your basic needs are not met as when you encounter the church, you will walk away. Now, I'm not just talking about in the building. If I'm wearing my cross and I go to the grocery store and I am not generous in my respect for the stranger, it's very likely that that person might see this and associate that with Christianity and become a person who now assumes we are judgmental, we are self-righteous, whatever, fill in the blank, right? So in a healthy congregation, we are constantly recognizing that a good number of people at any given moment, because they're tired, because they're just there for the first time, whatever it is, just need to be welcomed. That needs to happen all the time. When we feel safe, when we feel welcome, when we feel like, you know, we know where we are, we're not hungry and distracted, we found the bathroom, we can begin to recognize that there are other people here. We start to see that there are traditions. We start to notice the music. We start to notice the music has words, and the words speak to my heart. We hear a sermon, and we think, how did she know that I needed to hear that today? Like, how did she know? We start to feel familiar in the place. We start to have what is often called the goosebumps of faith when something happens and it just feels right. Silent Night on Christmas Eve is the classic example. People feel like Christmas Eve has happened when they sing Silent Night, dim the lights, the whole thing, right? That is when a theology of evangelism is actually being expressed. It's when the good news of Jesus Christ is connecting with me. I'm realizing that this group of people that gets together and behaves these ways believe something, and I want to be part of it. I want to connect with them. I feel a reward in being in this place. Now, my basic needs are still being met, or I wouldn't be able to do this. But you are now able to let me affiliate with you, and I start to feel known. I know your name, and you know my name. I notice when you're missing. We care about each other. We care about each other's children. We look after each other when things happen that are hard. We start to be a community of practice that exhibits a kind of love that is compassionate and joyful, and we have these traditions that we hold dear. Now, a lot of our churches do that really, really well. And they do it so well that that's what they keep doing, right? Now, some of us have that experience of church, all that wonderful good stuff, and for lots of different reasons, come to a place in our life where we have a moment of wrestling with something. All that nice, warm, fuzzy, good church stuff is great, but it's not enough. I need to ask a deeper question. Perhaps a marriage is breaking up, and one of the spouses is at church, and hearing praise and wonderful stories about God being loving is not congruent with their personal experience. Baltimore is erupting, and my priest isn't mentioning it. My own child is deviant and not going to school, and things are wrong, and or is incarcerated. Who can I tell? We're all so nice. People ask me how I am in the coffee hour, but can I really say my kid's in jail? When we reach that point, we have moved in this model through a moment of recognition, the green vertical, a moment of recognizing, like rethinking what we are experiencing. And we're starting to ask some hard questions. We're starting to say, if God is love, why is this breaking out in Baltimore? If we are all worthy, why are some people homeless? If we, you know, fill in the blank, if we are people who love God and honor peace, why do we go to war? Why do we have a military-industrial complex? Whatever your questions are, or just deeper questions about theology and systematic theology, like what is the essence of God? What does it mean to be human? When we begin to ask those questions is actually when we are most ripe for what the church traditionally calls catechesis, for teaching, for studying the faith. It's when we are ready to push against the tradition and have the tradition welcome that and wrestle with us and pack new information around us that we're ripe for learning. We want to know who we are as a child of God. I want to know at this point distinctly who I am, not just who we are, but who I am in my own unique personhood. So this is where we need to be expressing a theology of identity. We all know, right, in every church, if you've been in a congregation long enough, there's a few people who are always at adult ed, right? And there's a few of the few who always ask the pithy question. There's a few who just go because that's what you do and the coffee's good and, you know, their husband goes or their wife goes and they show up. But then there's a few who just are always, if you're the presenter, they're going to nail you with that one hard question. And sometimes they're very satisfied by what they get back. But too often, I think we stop there. We don't actually go far enough for them. They don't have a way to go deeper, or they haven't historically. We call this searching faith. So it's experienced faith, affiliative faith, searching faith. In Westerhoff's model, we have to go through this process of searching if we are going to come to what he ultimately calls owned faith, a faith that is mine. It's not borrowed, it's not copied, it's not watered down, it's mine. It's come from the generosity of the people who've loved me and walked with me and nurtured me in faith. It's come from the tradition, but it is mine because I have claimed it. I have reaffirmed it, and I now believe in it. I don't have all the answers, but I'm willing to say I believe. The Apostles' Creed is mine. I'm willing to stand and put my, you know, put my stake in the ground and say, yes, I'm a Christian. I'm willing to take action. And in fact, when I have owned faith, according to Westerhoff, I can't help but take action. These folks, and many of you are these folks, their lives are changed because they have been transformed in faith. And by being transformed, you want to give back. You feel blessed. You feel grateful. You feel that there's an urgency in the world that you want to address, whatever that particular thing is. And the blue bubble on the right says core leadership. In a perfect world, our Christian communities would create nurturing environments for people of all ages, from welcoming, experienced faith, through community life of affiliative faith, through searching life and searching faith and this theology of identity formation into owned faith. And we would draw our core leaders from owned faith. And then those core leaders will come back and become the hosts and the formers of faith for others who are yet beginning that journey. It is not a linear path. All of us go back and forth and back and forth and dip and season. We'll spend long periods of time in one place in this model. But what I'm proposing to you is that in too many of our congregations, we have become affiliative. We are communities. Every church says they're friendly. Every church says they're, you know, they're welcoming. And we really try to be. But it's so easy to welcome people like ourselves, right? It's so easy to just say we are because my friends are here. But we, all those nuns and all those people who have sort of walked away and those people who aren't so interested and think we're not relevant, don't see that group of us as particularly welcoming and certainly don't find themselves affiliating with us in a way that's useful to them yet. So what I would propose is that too often we draw our leadership from affiliative faith. We draw our leaders from people who are faithful, absolutely, who love the church, absolutely, who may pledge very generously, absolutely, but have not tested the waters of their own faith and actually have a fairly fragile faith, back to that religious literacy, are not that confident about what they mean and what they believe. And if you said, you know, talk to me about Jesus in your life, would just get a shriveled up Episcopal scary look, right? And I don't want to make that a bad thing. The bad thing is that we ask them to be leaders of other people in faith in ways that then make them feel like a fraud. Then make them feel as if they are inadequate, and then we wonder why they're done, right? We've asked them to be something they're not. And this is where young people are just more honest than some of us older folk. Teenagers walk out because they're not gonna lie. I don't know what I believe, or I don't believe that right now. So I'm not gonna sit here and be an imposter. I'm gonna go where I wanna go, to my friends or whatever. But we grown-ups are a little bit more, you know, socialized, and we stick around a little bit longer, and then we have a big fight, and we finally have an excuse to leave, and then we leave. So the real issue here for me is not where one is or where your congregation maps onto this model, but that we think carefully about what are the opportunities we provide to nurture people at all of these styles of faith that Westerhoff identified. Because they're there. Often the people who are really in the owned faith are very peripheral in the busyness of your parish. They don't want to deal with the busyness of the bureaucracy of church. They want to be working regularly at the soup kitchen. They want to be running community organizing efforts. They want to be changing laws and policies to change the system. Now the folks on the other end, the welcome folks, the folks who just visit, they're generous, they're kind, they're good people. If there's an issue in your town, they will gladly give you money to support it. They are ready to be there in that way. They're not ready to give themselves. They're not ready to put their own time in. The folks who are in the community stage, the affiliative faith, they're happy to go help at the soup kitchen if their friends are going. So if I say, you know, we're signed up to do the soup kitchen this Sunday at such and such a time, people will say, well, who else is going? And is John going? And if they're going, they'll be happy to go. A few of them who go regularly will then be the person who says, I thought this was a short-term shelter. Why are the same people here a year and a half after we've started coming? They're beginning to move into searching faith. They're beginning to ask sociological questions, perhaps, that are informed by their wonder about a broken world. That's a moment for formation. Do you see what I'm saying about this pattern, this movement? God does the moving. We can't push people anywhere. What we can do is respond to the love of God by creating environments that are nurturing and inviting, both in our buildings and in our lives well beyond the building, so that people are in fact constantly moving toward a more intimate relationship with God. That hunger that the people at Willow Creek had to go deeper, not broader. So, lifelong Christian formation, it is incredibly important. And the Episcopal Church has signed on. We have a charter for lifelong Christian formation. We signed on at our general convention in 2009. It says, lifelong Christian formation in the Episcopal Church is lifelong growth in the knowledge, service, and love of God as followers of Christ, and is informed by scripture, tradition, and reason. It's the horizon we're heading toward. It is the journey we're on, the ultimate promise of the reign of God. And God is beckoning all of us there. I'm challenging you to think about life-wide formation, to think about what's happening in the still small voices around you. What do you notice? What do you smell? Who are your friends? Who are the community people that are doing important work that you should join? What is it that's happening in your household? What is your child trying to tell you, or your grandchild? Listen, be thoughtful, be attentive. How will we know when we're there? I think we know, as C.S. Lewis says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. That's an owned faith speaking. Not only do I know the sun has risen, but through its rising I see everything else. I'm going to show you a very short video clip from Billy Elliot. Do you remember the movie Billy Elliot? So it's a coal mining town in England, very poor, declining economy. The unions are at war with the government. Young, kind of eccentric kid discovers a love for dance. His parents, are father particularly, are horrified. And then a kind of has-been dance teacher shows up in town, heavy smoker, coaches him in his teaching, in his dance, and then leads him to London for an audition. This is, I think, a glimpse of what it might be like if we were to truly commit ourselves to life-wide formation.
We shall let you know in due course.
Just one last question. Can I ask you, Billy, what does it feel like when you're dancing?
Then huh? It's sort of stiff in that. But once I get going, then I like forget everything. And I sort of disappear. Sort of disappear. Like I feel a change in my whole body. And like there's fire in my body. Just there. Flying. Like a bird. Like electricity. Yeah.
Have a safe journey home. Mr. Elliot, good luck with the strike.
Like electricity. I lose track of time. That's conversion, right? That's listening for the still small voice of God in that young man's voice, life. That's what life-wide formation might look like. It's us beginning to notice the capacities and potential that people have where they are and as they are. It's not asking them to come and be just like us. It's saying, where are the gifts that you already have that we can honor, that we can celebrate? How can we make you more fully who you are called to be? How can God, who loves you so generously, be made manifest in the life that you are living? And as I wrap up, I just want to leave you with some words from a hero of mine and many of yours, perhaps, Verna Dozier. A lay educator in the Episcopal Church, Washington, D.C., school teacher for many, many, many years, and a lay Bible scholar. So in Verna Dozier's words, she says, "What happens on Sunday morning is not half so important as what happens on Monday morning. In fact, what happens on Sunday morning is judged by what happens on Monday morning. There are no second-class citizens in the household of God. Religious authority comes with baptism, and it is nurtured by prayer, worship, Bible study, and life together." What Verna Dozier was famous for saying that I love and that we are going to play with tonight and tomorrow morning is, what will it take to say yes in a no world? What is it that we can say yes to by our way of being and by the way we structure our common life that will be so radical that it will invite people toward hope and transformation and away from fear and anxiety and despair? What is it that we can say yes to? So when you come back tonight, it's going to be a little more active. Bring something to write with. Okay, just a pencil or a pen. Thank you.